Antiquities, Book 8. A. How Solomon, on taking the kingdom, destroyed his enemies. B. Concerning his wisdom, his understanding, and his wealth. C. That he was the first to build the temple in Jerusalem. D. How, after Solomon's death, the people revolted from his son Rehoboam and set up Jeroboam, one of their own subjects, as king over the 10 tribes, while his son reigned over the remaining two. E. How Issachus, king of the Egyptians, campaigned against Jerusalem, took the city, and carried its wealth off to Egypt. F. The campaign of Jeroboam, king of the Israelites, against Rehoboam's son and his defeat. G. How a man named Bassanes destroyed Jeroboam's line and took the kingdom for himself. H. The campaign of the Ethiopians against Jerusalem, ruled at that time by Abijah's son, and the destruction of their army. I. How, after the line of Abesarus was destroyed, Amaris became king of the Israelites, and after him, his son Achabas. J. How Adad, king of Damascus and Syria, campaigned twice against Achabas and was defeated both times. K. The defeat of the Ammonites and Moabites when they campaigned against Jehoshaphat, king of Jerusalem. L. How Achabas campaigned against the Syrians, was defeated, and perished. This book covers 163 years. Concerning David, then, his virtue, and all the good he brought his countrymen through the wars and battles he won, we have given an account in the book before this one, in which he died in old age. His son Solomon, still young in years, took over the kingdom, which his father, while still alive, had already declared to be his by God's will. When he took his seat on the throne, the whole crowd cried out in acclamation, as is natural for a king at the start of his reign, wishing that his affairs turn out well, and that he come to a prosperous and altogether blessed old age in his rule. But Adonijah, who while his father was still alive had tried to seize power for himself, came to the mother of the king Bathsheba and greeted her warmly. When she asked whether he had come to her on some business and told him to speak freely, since she would gladly assist him, he began by saying that she herself knew the kingship had belonged to him, both because of his age and because of the people's preference. But that since it had passed to her son Solomon by God's judgment, he accepted this and was content with his present position, well pleased with it as it stood. He asked her, then, to do him a service with her son and persuade him to give him in marriage Abishag, the woman who had shared his father's bed, for his father had never had relations with her because of his old age, and she remained still a virgin. Bathsheba readily promised to assist him and to bring about the marriage on two counts, because the king would wish to grant her something, and because she herself would press him earnestly. So Adonijah went away hopeful about the marriage, while Solomon's mother went at once to her son to speak with him about what she had promised Adonijah at his request. Her son came out to meet her and embraced her, and after leading her into the house where the king's throne stood, he had another seat set to his right for his mother. Bathsheba sat down and said, "My son, grant me a favor, I ask, and do not, by refusing, make me sad or downcast." Solomon told her to command him, for it was right to grant a mother anything. And he added a mild reproach that she should not approach him without already firm confidence of obtaining what she asked, unless, suspecting a refusal, she meant to ask him to give the virgin Abishag in marriage to his brother Adonijah. At this, the king took the request badly and sent his mother away, saying that Adonijah was reaching for greater things, and that he was astonished she did not urge him to yield the kingship itself as well, to his elder brother, when she asked for the marriage to Abishag on behalf of a man who had powerful friends, Joab the general and Abiathar the priest. He then summoned Benaiah, the commander of his bodyguard, and ordered him to kill his brother Adonijah. And calling Abiathar the priest, he said, "Death is what your other offenses deserve, along with what you shared with my father and the ark you carried with him. But I lay on you this punishment instead, since you took Adonijah's side and shared his thinking. You are to be neither here nor ever again in my sight, but go to your own country and live out your life on your farms there, having forfeited, by your wrongdoing, any further right to your honor." So the house of Ithamar was removed from the priestly office for the reason just stated, just as God had foretold to Eli, the grandfather of Abiathar, and the office passed to the family of Phinehas, to Zadok. Those of the family of Phinehas who had lived as private citizens during the period when the high priesthood had passed to the house of Ithamar, beginning with Eli, the first of that house to hold it, were as follows. The son of the high priest Jesus was Bochias, his son was Jotham, Jotham's son was Marioth. Marioth's son was Arephaos. Arephaos's son was Achitob, and Achitob's son was Zadok, who was the first to become high priest under King David. When Joab the general heard of Adonijah's execution, he was struck with fear, for he had been a friend to him rather than to King Solomon, and not unreasonably suspecting danger for himself on account of his loyalty to Adonijah, he took refuge at the altar, believing that the king's piety toward God would secure his own safety there. When this was reported to the king by certain men, he sent Benaiah with orders to raise him up and bring him before the court to answer for himself. But Joab said he would not leave the sanctuary, and would rather die there than anywhere else. When Benaiah reported his answer to the king, Solomon ordered that his head be cut off there, just as he wished, and that this judgment be exacted from him for the two generals whom Joab had impiously killed, but that his body be buried, so that the guilt might never remain on his family, while he himself and his father should be free of any blame for Joab's death. Benaiah, having carried out these orders, was himself appointed general of the whole army, and the king made Zadok sole high priest in place of Abiathar, whom he had removed from that office. To Shimei, he gave orders that, having built himself a house, he should remain in Jerusalem attending on him, and that he had permission not to cross the Kidron Valley, but that if he disobeyed these terms, the penalty would be death. Given the weight of the threat, he also compelled him to bind himself by oath. Shimei said he was pleased with what Solomon had ordered and kept to it, living in Jerusalem for a time. But when 3 years had passed, hearing that two of his slaves had run off and were in Gath, he set out after his servants. When he came back with them, the king learned of it, and considering that Shimei had shown contempt for his commands and, worse still, had taken no account of his oaths before God, he was greatly displeased and, summoning him, said, "Did you not swear never to leave this city for another? You will not escape the penalty for your perjury, and for that, and for the insults you offered my father during his flight, I will punish you now that you have shown yourself wicked again, so that you may know that the wicked gain nothing by not being punished at the very moment of their crime. Rather, for the whole time they think themselves safe from any consequence, their punishment grows and becomes greater than what they would have paid had they been punished for their offense at once." And at the king's command, Benaiah killed Shimei. Now that Solomon held the kingdom securely and his enemies had been punished, he married the daughter of Pharaoh, king of the Egyptians. He also built up the walls of Jerusalem, making them far greater and stronger than they had been before, and administered the kingdom's affairs, not, despite his youth, in a manner that harmed justice or the keeping of the laws or the memory of what his father had charged him at his death, but carrying out everything with the same thoroughness as men advanced in years and at the height of their judgment. He decided, on going to Gibron, to sacrifice to God upon the bronze altar built by Moses, and offered a great number of burnt sacrifices there. By doing this, he was thought to have honored God greatly, for God appeared to him in a dream that same night and told him to choose what gifts he wished to receive in return for his devotion. Solomon did not ask God for the finest and greatest things a man might desire for himself, as most men, being human and young, would think worth striving for, the things that most people consider alone worthy of pursuit and reckon as gifts from God. Instead, he said, "Grant me, Master, a sound mind and good judgment, by which, in dealing with the people, I may discern what is true and just and render judgment accordingly." God was pleased with this request and promised to give him, besides all the other things he had not mentioned in his choice, wealth, glory, and victory over his enemies, and above all understanding and wisdom such as no other man had ever had, whether king or commoner, and to preserve the kingdom for his descendants for a very long time, provided he remained just, obedient to him, and an imitator of his father in those things in which his father had excelled. When Solomon heard this from God, he leapt up at once from his bed, bowed down before him, and returned to Jerusalem, where he offered great sacrifices before the tabernacle and gave a feast for all the Jews. In those days, a difficult case was brought before him, one whose resolution was hard to find, and I have thought it necessary to relate the matter at issue in this trial, so that the difficulty of the judgment may be plain, and so that readers, coming to know such matters, may grasp, as though from an image of it, the king's quickness of mind, and his ability to pronounce readily on what was in question. Two women who lived by prostitution came before him, and the one who claimed to have been wronged spoke first, saying, "I live, O king, together with this woman in one room. It happened that on the same day, at the same hour, we each gave birth to a male child. On the third day, this woman, having lain on her own child in her sleep, killed it. Then she took mine from my lap, carried it to herself, and placed the dead child in my arms while I slept. In the morning, wishing to offer the child the breast, I could not find my own child, but saw hers lying dead beside me, for I recognized it at once on close examination. So I demand back my son, and since I cannot get him, I have come, master, to beg your help. For since we are alone and no one can prove the truth, she relies on her stubborn denial, having no fear because there is no witness." When she had said this, the king questioned the other woman as to what she had to say in answer to these charges. She claimed to have done no such thing, said the living child was hers and the dead one belonged to her opponent. And since no one could see how to reach a judgment, but all felt as if faced with a riddle, their minds baffled over how to find the truth, the king alone thought of a way. He ordered both the dead child and the living one brought to him, summoned one of his bodyguards, drew his sword, and commanded him to cut the children in two, so that each woman might receive half of both the living child and the dead one. At this, the whole crowd secretly mocked the king as a mere boy. But meanwhile, the true mother, the one who had made the claim, cried out that he must not do this, but should give the child to the other woman as hers. For it was enough for her that it lived and that she could see it, even if it seemed to belong to someone else, while the other woman was quite willing to see the child divided, and even asked that she herself be put to the ordeal. The king, recognizing from each woman's words which spoke from the truth, awarded the child to the one who had cried out, judging that she was truly the mother, and condemned the wickedness of the other, who had killed her own child and was eager to see her friend's child destroyed as well. The people considered this a great proof and demonstration of the king's good judgment and wisdom, and from that day on they regarded him as one possessed of a more than human understanding. The generals and governors he had over the whole country were as follows. Over the district of Ephraim was Urs. Over the toparchy of Bithyms was Diaclaros. Over Dor and the coastal region was Abinadab, who held it under the king, having married Solomon's daughter. The great plain was under Banias, son of Achilles, who also had charge of the whole region as far as the Jordan. Gilead and Golanitis, up to Mount Lebanon, together with 60 large and very strongly fortified cities, were governed by Gabers. Achinadab governed the whole of Galilee as far as Sidon, he too being married to a daughter of Solomon, named Basima. The coastal region around Acre was held by Banachates. Saphates was entrusted with the whole region of Mount Tabor, Carmel, and Lower Galilee as far as the Jordan River. Salmuis had charge of the district of Benjamin. Gabers held the country across the Jordan, and over these another single governor had again been appointed. Under this arrangement, both the Hebrew people and the tribe of Judah made great progress, turning to farming and the care of the land. For enjoying peace, undisturbed by wars or upheavals, and moreover reveling without restraint in the freedom they had longed for, each man devoted himself to increasing what was his own and to making it worth still more. Solomon had other governors as well, who administered the land of the Syrians and of the foreign peoples stretching from the Euphrates River all the way to Egypt, collecting for him tribute from those nations. These also supplied, each day, for the king's table and dinner, 30 measures of fine flour and 60 of ordinary flour, 10 fattened oxen and 20 pasture-fed oxen, and 100 fattened lambs. All this besides these, I mean deer taken in hunting, and gazelles and birds, and fish, foodstuffs were brought daily to the king from the peoples of foreign nations. So great was the number of Solomon's chariots that there were 40,000 stalls for the horses that drew them. And besides these, there were 12,000 horsemen, half of whom stayed in attendance on the king at Jerusalem, while the rest were quartered among the royal villages, scattered about and remaining there. The same officer who was entrusted with the king's expenditure also supplied provisions for the horses, gathering them to wherever the king happened to be staying. So great was the understanding and wisdom God gave Solomon that he surpassed the men of old, and was found not merely to fall a little short of the Egyptians, who are said to excel all peoples in intelligence. But, when compared with him, to stand at the greatest possible distance from the king's wisdom. He rose above and surpassed in wisdom even those who at that time had a reputation among the Hebrews for cleverness, whose names I will not pass over. They were Athenus, Hamenus, Chalcius, and Dardanus, sons of Hemon. He also composed 1,005 books of odes and songs, and 3,000 books of parables and comparisons. For he uttered a parable concerning every kind of tree, from the hyssop to the cedar, and in the same way concerning cattle and all creatures of the earth, the sea, and the air. There was no nature he failed to know or left unexamined, but on every one of them he philosophized and displayed the utmost knowledge of their particular properties. God also granted him to learn the art that works against demons, for the benefit and healing of mankind. He composed incantations by which sicknesses are relieved, and left behind methods of exorcism by which those possessed by demons expel them so that they never return. This therapy still retains great power among us to this day, for I have set on record a certain Eleazar, one of our own people, who, in the presence of Vespasian, his sons, his tribunes, and a great crowd of other soldiers, freed men possessed by demons. The manner of the cure was this. He held to the nostrils of the possessed man a ring that had, set beneath its seal, a root of the kind Solomon had indicated. And then, as the man drew in its scent through his nostrils, drew the demon out through them, and the man immediately fell down, whereupon Eleazar adjured the demon, invoking the name of Solomon and reciting the incantations he had composed, never to return into him. And wishing to persuade the bystanders and prove to them that he truly possessed this power, Eleazar would set down a little way off either a cup full of water or a basin, and command the demon, as it went out of the man, to overturn it, so as to give the onlookers proof that it had left the man. Once this had happened, the understanding and wisdom of Solomon stood plainly revealed. And it is on account of this, so that all men might know the greatness of his nature and how beloved he was of God, and so that no one under the sun should remain ignorant of the king's surpassing excellence in every kind of virtue, that we have been led to speak of these matters. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, on hearing that Solomon had succeeded to his father's kingdom, rejoiced greatly, for he had been a friend of David's, and he sent envoys to greet him and to share in his joy over the blessings now his. Solomon in turn sent him a letter, which read as follows. King Solomon to King Hiram. Know that my father wished to build a temple to God, but was prevented by his wars and his unceasing campaigns, for he did not stop subduing his enemies until he had made every one of them tributary to him. I, however, give thanks to God for the peace I now enjoy, and since this peace has given me leisure, I wish to build the house for God, for God foretold to my father that it would be built by me. I ask you then to send some of your people along with mine to Mount Lebanon to cut timber, for in the felling of timber the Sidonians are more skilled than our own people. Whatever wage you set, I will provide it to the woodcutters. When Hiram had read the letter and had welcomed what was asked of him, he wrote back to Solomon. King Hiram to King Solomon, it is right to bless God that he has handed your father's rule to you, a wise man possessed of every virtue. I, for my part, am glad of this and will supply all that has been asked. I will have much great timber cut, both cedar and cypress, and will send it down by my own men to the sea, and will order my people to build it into rafts and sail to whatever place in your own territory you wish, and set it down there. From there your own men will carry it on to Jerusalem. In return, see that you supply us with grain, since we, living on an island, stand in need of it. To this day copies of these letters remain preserved, not only among our own records, but also among the Tyrians, so that anyone who wishes to learn the exact truth may inquire of the public keepers of the Tyrian archives and find that what is preserved there agrees with what I have reported. I have gone through all this because I wanted my readers to know that we are asserting nothing beyond the truth, and that we are not, by weaving together some plausible tale designed to deceive and entertain, trying to evade scrutiny while demanding instant belief. Nor do we consider that, once we depart from what befits serious history, we ought to go unquestioned. Rather, we ask no credence at all, unless we are able to make the truth evident by demonstration and firm proof. When King Solomon received the letter from the king of Tyre, he commended his eagerness and his goodwill, and repaid him in the manner he had requested, sending him every year 20,000 cores of grain and as many baths of oil, a bath holding 72 pints, and supplying the same measure of wine besides. And from these dealings, the friendship of Hiram and Solomon grew still greater, and the two swore to maintain it forever. The king also levied on the whole people a labor force of 30,000 men, whose toil he arranged so as to spare them hardship, dividing it wisely. He sent 10,000 to cut timber in Lebanon for 1 month, and then let them rest for 2 months, returning to their homes, until the next group of 20,000 had completed their turn of duty in due order, so that it came about that the first 10,000 returned to the work every 4th month. Adoram was set as overseer of this levy. Of the resident foreigners whom David had left behind, 70,000 carried the stone and the rest of the material, and 80,000 were stone cutters, with 3,300 overseers set over them. Solomon had ordered them to cut great stones for the foundations of the temple, and having first fitted and bound them together on the mountain, to bring them down in that condition to the city. And this work was carried out not only by the local builders, but also by the craftsmen Hiram had sent. Solomon began the building of the temple in the 4th year of his reign, in the 2nd month, which the Macedonians call Artemisios and the Hebrews Iyar, 592 years after the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, 1,020 years after Abraham's arrival in Canaan from Mesopotamia, and 1,440 years after the flood. While from the birth of the first man, Adam, to the time when Solomon built the temple, 3,102 years in all had passed. At the time the temple began to be built, the 11th year of Hiram's reign at Tyre had already begun, and 240 years had passed since the founding of that city to the building of the temple. The king laid the foundations of the temple at the greatest possible depth in the ground, with stones strong enough to endure through time. Joined to the earth, these stones were to serve as floor and support for the structure to be raised upon them, and, by their strength from below, to bear without strain both the mass of what would rest above and the costliness of its ornament. A weight no less than everything else devised for height, for bulk, for beauty, and for splendor. He raised the building, made of white stone, all the way to the roof. Its height was 60 cubits, its length the same, and its breadth 20. Above this stood another structure equal to it in measure, so that the whole height of the temple came to 120 cubits, and it faced east. Its porch they set before it, 20 cubits in length, spanning the width of the building, 10 cubits deep, and raised to a height of 120 cubits. Around the temple he built, in a circle, 30 small chambers, meant to bind the whole structure together by being packed closely and in great number around the outside, and he even built passages connecting them to one another. Each of these chambers had a width of 5 cubits, the same in length, and a height of 20. Above them, other chambers were built, and above those again, still others, equal in both measurements and number, so that their combined height came to match that of the lowest chamber, for the uppermost story was not built all the way around. Their roof was laid with cedar. For each chamber, this roofing was its own, not joined to its neighbors, but for the rest, the roof was shared, being built through one another with very long beams that ran the whole length, so that the walls between them, held together by these same timbers, were made stronger for it. The ceiling beneath the beams, made of the same wood, he had carved throughout into paneling and overlaid with gold. He lined the walls with cedar planks and worked gold into them, so that the whole temple gleamed, and the eyes of those entering were dazzled by the brilliance of gold streaming from every side. The entire construction of the temple was carried out with such great skill, of hewn stones fitted together so harmoniously and smoothly, that no mark of hammer or any other builder's tool could be detected by a careful observer. The material had been joined together so naturally, without any visible use of such tools, that the fit seemed to have come about of its own accord rather than by the constraint of tools. The king also devised an ascent to the upper chamber through the thickness of the wall, since it had no large door on the east side as the lower chamber did, but had entrances from the sides through very small doors. He lined the temple, both within and without, with cedar timbers bound by thick chains, so that these served in place of buttressing and reinforcement. Dividing the temple into two, he made the inner chamber, 20 cubits long, the innermost sanctuary, and designated the 40-cubit chamber the holy place. Cutting through the middle wall, he set up cedar doors overlaid with much gold and worked with varied engraving, and before these he hung curtains of the richest colors, woven of blue, purple, and scarlet, as well as of the brightest and softest linen. In the innermost sanctuary, 20 cubits wide and the same in length, he set up two cherubim of solid gold, each 5 cubits in height, each having two wings stretched out to a length of 5 cubits. For this reason, he set them up not far apart from one another, so that with one wing each touched the wall of the sanctuary, the one on the south side, the other on the north, while their remaining wings, joining one another, formed a covering over the ark placed between them. What the cherubim actually looked like, no one is able to say or even guess. He also paved the floor of the temple with plates of gold, and set upon the temple's gateway doors proportioned to the height of the wall, 20 cubits in width, and these two he overlaid with gold. In short, he left no part of the temple, inside or out, that was not gold, and he hung curtains over these doors as well, matching those within. The doorway of the porch alone had none of these. Solomon sent to Tyre, and had Hiram send him a craftsman named Chiromus, whose mother was of the tribe of Naphtali, for it was from her that he belonged to that tribe, while his father, Uri, was an Israelite by descent. This man was skilled in every kind of craft, but above all, he was a master at working gold, silver, and bronze, and it was through him that everything concerning the temple was carried out according to the king's design. This Chiromus also made two bronze pillars, 4 fingers thick, hollow within. The pillars stood 18 cubits high, with a circumference of 12 cubits, and cast atop each capital stood a lily raised to a height of 5 cubits, around which was set a network of bronze woven like fir branches, covering the lilies. From this network hung, in 2 rows, 200 pomegranates. Of these 2 pillars, he set the one on the right of the porch's doorpost, naming it Jachin, and the other on the left, naming it Bose. He also cast a bronze sea, shaped as a hemisphere. The bronze work was called the sea on account of its size, for the basin measured 10 cubits across and was cast to the thickness of a handbreadth. It was supported around the middle of its body by a molding that ran around it in 10 coils. This molding was 1 cubit across, and around it stood 12 oxen, facing toward the 4 quarters of the winds, 3 of them turned in each direction, their hindquarters inward, so that the hemisphere rested upon them, sloping inward all the way around. The sea held 3,000 baths. He also made 10 bronze stands for basins, square in shape. Each of these measured 5 cubits in length, 4 in breadth, and 6 in height, and the work enclosing it was wrought section by section in this manner. There stood 4 small pillars at the corners, square in their sides, each having its base fitted into it on either side. These stands were divided into 3 panels, and each panel was framed by a border worked in relief, showing here a lion, there a bull or an eagle, while the small columns were carved to match the reliefs on the panels beside them. The whole structure stood mounted on 4 wheels, which were cast in 1 piece, with naves and rims 1.5 cubits in diameter. Anyone who saw the curved sections of the wheels would have marveled at how skillfully they were worked, so smoothly joined to the sides of the stands and fitted to the rims, and such indeed they were. At the top, the corners were closed off by shoulders formed of upraised arms, on which rested a curved support shaped to cradle the basin, which rested upon the hands. An eagle and a lion were fitted to these so closely that they seemed, to anyone looking, to have grown together naturally with them, and between these figures palm trees were carved in relief. Such was the design of the 10 stands. He also had 10 round bronze basins made, shaped like cooking pots, each holding 40 baths, for their height was 4 cubits, and their rims stood the same distance apart. These basins he set upon the 10 stands called the Mechanoth. 5 basins he placed on the left side of the temple, which faced north, and the same number on the right, facing south toward the east. And in the same place he set the sea as well. When he had filled them with water, he designated the sea for the priests entering the temple to wash their hands and feet in before going up to the altar, and the basins for cleansing the inner parts of the animals offered as whole burnt offerings, and their feet as well. He also had a bronze altar made, 20 cubits long and the same in width, and 10 cubits high, for the burnt offerings. He had all the equipment for it made of bronze as well, foot basins and lifting implements. And besides these, Chiromis fashioned cauldrons, flesh hooks, and every kind of vessel out of bronze whose brightness and beauty matched gold. The king also dedicated a great number of tables, one large golden one, on which the loaves of God were set out, and countless others resembling it, made in a different way, on which were placed the vessels, bowls, and libation cups, 20,000 of gold and 40,000 of silver. He also had 10,000 lampstands made in accordance with the command of Moses, of which he dedicated one to the temple, so that it might burn daily as the law prescribed, and one table set with loaves on the north side of the temple, opposite the lampstand, for that one he set toward the south, while the golden altar stood between them. All these things the house of 40 cubits held, in front of the veil of the inner sanctuary, in which the ark was to be placed. The king also had 80,000 wine pitchers made, and 10,000 golden bowls and twice as many of silver, 80,000 golden dishes for offering the fine flour needed for the altar, and twice that number of silver ones, 60,000 golden mixing bowls in which the flour was mixed with oil, and twice that number of silver ones, and vessels of the measures called, according to the terms of Moses, Hin, and Si, corresponding 20,000 of gold and twice that number of silver. Golden censers for carrying incense into the temple, 20,000, and likewise another 50,000 censers for carrying fire from the great altar to the small altar within the temple. He made 1,000 priestly robes for the high priests, complete with the full-length garment, the ephod, the breastplate, and the precious stones. The crown on which Moses had inscribed the name of God was one, and it has survived to this very day. He also had the priestly robes made of fine linen and 10,000 purple sashes for each priest. Following the command of Moses, he made 200,000 trumpets and 200,000 robes of fine linen for the Levites who sang the hymns, and the musical instruments devised for the singing of hymns, called nablas and kanyras, he had made of electrum, 40,000 of them. All these things Solomon made at lavish expense and with great magnificence for the honor of God, sparing nothing, but applying every ambition to the adornment of the temple. And these he stored away in the treasuries of God. Around the temple he set a cornice, called in the local tongue a jason, and by the Greeks a trinchos, raising its height to 3 cubits, to bar the mass of the people from entering the sanctuary and to signal that entry was permitted to the priests alone. Outside this he built a further sacred precinct, raising great, broad colonnades in a square arrangement, opened by lofty gates, each of which faced one of the four directions and was closed with golden doors. Into this precinct came all those among the people who excelled in purity and in observance of the laws. This outer sacred precinct he made a thing of wonder, surpassing all description and, one might say, even belief, for he filled in immense ravines, so deep that one could not look down into them without difficulty even by peering over the edge, and raised them to a height of 400 cubits, level with the summit of the mountain on which the temple was built. And because of this, the outer precinct, though open to the sky, was made equal in extent to the temple itself. He enclosed it with double colonnades built of natural stone, its height supported on columns, their roofs were of cedar, carved in coffered panels. All the doors of this outer precinct he covered entirely with silver. These, then, were the works, and the size and beauty of the buildings, and of the offerings dedicated to the temple, which King Solomon completed in 7 years, making a display of both his wealth and his zeal, so that anyone seeing them would have supposed that the whole span of time would have been needed to build such works, so vast were they in relation to the size of the temple, whereas in fact they were completed in so short a period. He then wrote to the leaders and elders of the Hebrews and ordered the whole people to be gathered at Jerusalem, both to see the temple and to bring the ark of God into it. And when the summons to come to Jerusalem had been proclaimed to all, they assembled with difficulty in the 7th month, called Athar by the local people, and Hyperbarateos by the Macedonians. It happened that the season of the Feast of Tabernacles fell at the same time, a festival held by the Hebrews to be extremely holy and the greatest of all. So they took up the ark and the tent that Moses had set up, and all the vessels used in the service of the sacrifices to God, and carried them to the temple. The king himself went ahead with sacrifices, together with all the people and the Levites, drenching the road with libations and the blood of many victims, and burning incense in such abundance that the whole surrounding air was filled with it, so that even those at the greatest distance perceived its sweetness and recognized, in human terms, the visitation and dwelling of God in a place newly built and consecrated for him. For indeed, singing hymns and dancing all the way, they did not grow weary until they reached the temple. In this manner they brought the ark across. But when it had to be carried into the inner sanctuary, the rest of the crowd withdrew, and only the priests, carrying it, set it down between the two cherubim, whose wings, for they had been fashioned this way by the craftsmen, were interlaced, and they covered the ark as if with a kind of tent and canopy. The ark contained nothing but the two stone tablets, which preserved, inscribed upon them, the 10 words spoken by God to Moses on Mount Sinai. The lampstand, the table, and the golden altar they set up in the temple before the inner sanctuary, in the same places they had occupied when they stood in the tent, and there they continued to offer the daily sacrifices. The bronze altar he set up in front of the temple, opposite the door, so that when it was opened, it would face the altar directly, and the sacred rites and the lavishness of the offerings could be seen. All the remaining vessels the priests gathered together and stored inside the temple. When the priests had arranged everything concerning the ark and had come out, suddenly a dense mist, not harsh, nor such as is heavy with rain in winter, settled and, spreading and mingling through the air, poured into the temple, so that it darkened the sight of the priests, making them unable to see one another, while in the minds of all it produced the impression and conviction that God had descended into the sanctuary and had taken up gracious residence within it. While the others remained absorbed in this thought, King Solomon rose, for he happened to be sitting, and addressed words to God which he judged fitting to the divine nature and proper for him to speak. "For you, O Master," he said, "we know that you have made for yourself an eternal and worthy dwelling in heaven, and in air, earth, and sea, which together do not contain you even though you fill them all. But this temple I have built for you as a place named after you, so that from it we may send up our prayers and sacrifices to you through the air, and remain convinced that you are present and not far off, even from us yourself. For while you see and hear all things, you never abandon, even now, your dwelling where it befits you to dwell, in order to be nearest to all. Rather, you are present with each person alike, both in council and through night and day." Having spoken these words of devotion to God, he turned his address to the people, making known to them the power and providence of God. How he had disclosed to David his father, in the matter of things to come, all that had already come to pass and all that still remained, and how he himself had given the name to a son not yet born, and had foretold what he would be called, and that this son, once he became king after his father's death, would build the temple for him. And seeing these things fulfilled according to that prophecy, he urged them to bless God and to despair of nothing he had promised toward their happiness, trusting from what they now saw that it would indeed come to pass. Having spoken these things to the crowd, the king turned again to face the temple and, raising his right hand toward the people, said, "By deeds it is not possible for men to repay God for the good they have received from him, for the divine is in need of nothing and is greater than any such recompense. But by that faculty by which we have been made superior to the other creatures, O Master, it is necessary for us to bless your majesty, and to give thanks for what has been granted to our house and to the house of the Hebrews. For by what other means is it more fitting for us to propitiate one who is angry and displeased, and render him gracious toward us, than by the voice we have from the air and no returns again through it? I therefore acknowledge my gratitude to you through it, first concerning my father, whom you raised from obscurity to such great glory, and then on my own behalf, for having brought to pass, up to this present day, all that you foretold. And I beg that for the time to come you will supply whatever power God grants to men honored by you, and that you will increase our house in every way, as you promised to David my father both in his lifetime and at his death, that the kingdom would remain with us and that his line would succeed to it through countless generations. Grant us this, then, and to my children, and give them the virtue in which you delight. Beyond this, I beseech you also to send some portion of your spirit to dwell in the temple, so that you may seem to us to be present on earth as well. For to you even the whole vault of heaven and all that lies within it is a small dwelling place, let alone this temple, ordinary as it is. But I ask you to keep it forever unravaged by enemies as your own possession, and to watch over it as your own property. And if ever the people should sin, and afterward on account of that sin, be struck by some evil affliction from you, barrenness of the land, a plague of pestilence, or any of those sufferings by which you punish those who transgress any of your holy laws, and the whole people gather and take refuge at the temple, imploring you and begging to be saved, hear them as though you were present within it, have mercy, and free them from their misfortunes. And I ask that this help from you be not for the Hebrews alone, but that if any should come even from the ends of the inhabited world, from wherever they may be, turning to you in supplication and entreating to obtain some good thing, you would grant it to them as well, hearing their prayer. For in this way, all would learn that you yourself desired this house to be built for you among us, and that we are not by nature inhuman, nor ill-disposed toward those who are not of our own people, but have wished the help that comes from you and the benefit of good things to belong to all in common. Having said these things, and having thrown himself upon the ground and worshipped for a long while, he rose and offered sacrifices to God, and having provided a great quantity of unblemished victims, he came to know clearly, and with joy that God accepted the sacrifice, for fire ran down from the air, and in full view of all, darted upon the altar and consumed the whole offering. When this manifestation occurred, the people, supposing it to be a sign that God would dwell in the temple, rejoiced and fell prostrate on the ground in worship, while the king began to bless God and urge the people to do the same, since they now had proof of God's goodwill toward them, praying that his favor would always turn out this way for them, and that they should keep their minds pure from all wickedness, in righteousness and reverence, and in keeping the commandments that God had given them through Moses, and that these would endure. For in this way, the nation of the Hebrews would be prosperous and more blessed than any other race of men. He urged them also to remember that by the same means by which they had gained their present blessings, they would keep them secure and make them still greater and more abundant. For it was not by taking gained through piety and justice alone, but that they should also expect to keep them for the same reasons. For men, it was not so great a thing to acquire what they did not yet have as to preserve what they had gained and suffer no harm to it. Having addressed these words to the people, the king dissolved the assembly, after offering sacrifices on behalf of himself and all the Hebrews, 22,000 oxen slaughtered, and 120,000 sheep. For it was then that the temple first tasted sacred offerings, and all the Hebrews feasted in it together with their wives and children. And the king, together with the whole people, kept the festival called Tabernacles before the temple splendidly and magnificently for twice 7 days. When they had feasted there sufficiently and nothing was lacking to their piety toward God, each of them, once the king had dismissed them, went home giving thanks to the king for his care of them and for the works he had shown them. And having prayed to God to preserve Solomon as their king for a long time, they made their way home with joy and gladness, singing hymns to God, so that all completed the road to their own homes without effort, from sheer pleasure. And those who had brought the ark into the temple, having beheld its greatness and beauty, and shared in the great sacrifices and festivities held over it, returned each to their own cities. A dream appeared to the king as he slept and signified to him that God had heard his prayer, and that he would guard the temple and remain in it forever, so long as his descendants and he himself and the whole people continued to act justly, and that he himself, if he remained faithful to his father's precepts, would be raised to a height and greatness of prosperity beyond measure, and that those of his line and of the tribe of Judah would always rule the land. If, however, he betrayed these practices, forgot them, and turned to worship foreign gods, God would root them out utterly, leaving no remnant of his line, nor would he look on the people of Israel unharmed, but would destroy them with countless wars and calamities, and would cast them out of the land he had given to their fathers and settle foreign newcomers in it. The temple now built would be handed over to their enemies to be burned and plundered, and the city itself would be razed by the hands of enemies, and their sufferings would become fit for legend, so extreme and so incredible that neighboring peoples, hearing of the disaster, would marvel and ask the reason why the Hebrews, once brought by God to glory and wealth, had come to be so hated by him, and would hear from the survivors, confessing, of their sins and their transgressions of their ancestral laws. Such is what has been recorded as God's words to him in his sleep. After the building of the temple, completed in 7 years as we have said before, he laid the foundations of the royal palace, which he barely finished in 13 years. For it was not pursued with the same zeal as the temple. The temple, though great and of wonderful and extraordinary workmanship, and moreover with God's cooperation working toward its completion, was finished within the years already stated. But the palace, being far inferior in worth to the temple, since the materials for it had not been prepared over so long a time and with the same devotion, and since it was to be a dwelling for kings and not for God, was completed more slowly. These buildings, worthy of note, were constructed in keeping with the prosperity of the land of the Hebrews and of the king. But it is necessary to describe their whole arrangement and disposition, so that those who are to read this account may from it be able to form some conjecture and grasp their scale. There was a great and beautiful house, supported by many columns, which he built to receive and accommodate a crowd of people gathering for lawsuits and the settling of disputes. 100 cubits in length, 50 in breadth, and 30 in height, upheld by square pillars all of cedar, roofed in the Corinthian style, with door frames and triple-grooved doorways of matching proportions, at once secure and richly adorned. Another building stood in the middle, set across the whole width, square, 30 cubits in breadth, having facing it a hall raised on thick pillars. In it was a splendid alcove where the king sat in judgment, and adjoining it was built another house for the queen and the remaining chambers meant for daily life and rest after the dispatch of business, all floored with cedar planks cut to measure. Some parts he built of stones 10 cubits long. The walls he clad with another kind of sawn and costly stone, quarried in places renowned for producing it, used to adorn temples and royal palaces. And the beauty derived from this stone was woven in for 3 courses, while a 4th section displayed the skill of carvers, by whom trees and plants of every kind had been fashioned, shaded with branches and hanging leaves, so delicately worked that one would suspect them to be actually stirring. So fine was the craftsmanship concealing the stone beneath them. The rest, up to the roof, was plastered and richly decorated with colors and dyes. He further built, in addition to these, other chambers for luxury and enjoyment, and very long colonnades placed in a fine position within the palace, among which was a most splendid hall for feasting and banquets, filled with gold. And all the other furnishings needed for the service of those feasting were made entirely of gold. It is difficult to enumerate the size and variety of the palace. How many were its greatest chambers, how many the lesser ones beneath them, how many underground and hidden, together with the beauty of the rooms open to the air, and the groves for the most delightful viewing, and as a refuge and shelter for the body in summer. In sum, he built the whole structure of white stone, cedar, gold, and silver, adorning the ceilings and walls with stones set in gold in the same manner in which he had likewise embellished the temple of God. He also made, as part of the throne's construction, an ivory seat of the greatest size, having 6 steps, and on each of these, on either side, stood 2 lions, with as many others standing above them. The armrest of the throne consisted of hands that received the king, and the back was fashioned into the likeness of a calf's head, facing backward, and the whole was bound in gold. Solomon completed all this over 20 years. Since the king of the Tyrians, Hiram, had contributed much gold and even more silver to the building, as well as timber of cedar and pine, Solomon in turn repaid him with great gifts, sending him grain, wine, and oil year by year, of which Hiram was in particular need on account of living on an island, as we have already said. In addition, he presented him with 20 cities of Galilee not far from Tyre. But Hiram, having gone to inspect them and being dissatisfied with the gift, sent word to Solomon that he had no need of the cities, and from then on they were called the land of Chabalin. And Chabalin, translated according to the Phoenician tongue, means not pleasing. The king of the Tyrians also sent Solomon riddles and enigmatic sayings, asking him to solve them and relieve him of the difficulty of the questions contained in them. Solomon, being clever and shrewd, let none of them pass him by, but mastered them all by reasoning and, having grasped their meaning, resolved them. Menander, who translated the Tyrian archives from the Phoenician dialect into the Greek language, mentions these two kings, speaking as follows. When Abibalus died, his son Hiram succeeded to the kingdom. He lived 53 years and reigned 34. He filled in the Eurochorus and set up the golden pillar in the temple of Zeus. He also went and cut timber from the mountain called Lebanon for the roofs of the temples. Tearing down the ancient shrines, he built a temple to Heracles and to Astarte, and he was the first to hold the festival of the raising of Heracles in the month Parishis. He also campaigned against the people of Utica, who were withholding their tribute, and having subdued them again, returned. In his time there was a young son of Abdemen, who always won at the problems Solomon, king of Jerusalem, set. Dias also mentions this, speaking as follows. When Abibalus died, his son Hiram reigned. He filled in the eastern parts of the city and enlarged the town, and having filled in the area between it and the temple of Olympian Zeus, which stood by itself, he joined it to the city and adorned it with golden offerings, and he went up to Lebanon and cut timber for the building of the temples. He says that Solomon, ruler of Jerusalem, sent riddles to Hiram and asked to receive some from him in turn, and that whoever failed to solve them should pay money to the other. And that Hiram, having agreed but being unable to solve the riddles, spent much money as the penalty. Then a certain Abdemen, a man of Tyre, solved the ones proposed and himself proposed others, which Solomon, failing to solve, had to pay a great sum of money back to Hiram. So Dias has told it. When the king saw that the walls of Jerusalem needed towers for security and other fortification, for he considered that the enclosures ought to match the dignity of the city, he further strengthened them and reinforced them with great towers. He also built cities counted among the most important, Hazor and Megiddo and third, Jezer, which belonging to the land of the Philistines, Pharaoh, king of the Egyptians, had taken by storm after marching against it and besieging it. And having killed all its inhabitants, he raised it, and then gave it as a gift to his daughter, who was married to Solomon. For this reason, the king rebuilt it, since it was naturally strong and could serve for wars and the changing circumstances of the times. Not far from it, he built two other cities. One was named Beth-horon, the other was called Baalath. In addition to these, he built others suited for enjoyment and luxury, being well favored both in the mildness of their climate and in their seasonal fruits and their springs of flowing water. He also advanced into the desert of Upper Syria, and having taken possession of it, founded there a very great city, 2 days' journey distant from Upper Syria, 1 day's journey from the Euphrates, and 6 days' journey in length from Great Babylon. The reason the city was settled so far from the inhabited parts of Syria was that nowhere in the region below was water to be found, but springs and wells were discovered only in that place. Having built this city and surrounded it with very strong walls, he named it Tadmor, and it is still so called by the Syrians to this day, while the Greeks call it Palmyra. King Solomon, then, spent that period of time occupied with these matters. As for those who have raised the question why all the kings of Egypt, from Minyas, who built Memphis, and who lived many years before our forefather Abraham, down to Solomon, more than 1,300 years intervening, were called pharaohs, taking this title from a king named Pharaoh who ruled among them in the intervening times, I have thought it necessary to speak, in order to dispel their ignorance and make clear the reason for the name. That pharaoh, in the Egyptian tongue, signifies king. I suppose that they, using other names from childhood, changed their names upon becoming kings, adopting according to their ancestral language the name signifying their authority. For indeed the kings of Alexandria too, formerly called by other names, were called Ptolemies once they took the throne, after the first king. And the emperors of the Romans likewise, though known from birth by other names, are called Caesars, this title being given them by their office and rank, rather than continuing with the names given them by their fathers. I also think that Herodotus of Halicarnassus, for this reason, in saying that after Minyas, who built Memphis, 330 kings of Egypt arose, did not give their names, because they were all commonly called Pharaoh. Indeed, after the death of these kings, when a woman came to reign, he gives her name, calling her Nicol, showing that while male kings could all share the same title, a woman could no longer share in it, and for this reason he gave her own natural name. I myself, moreover, have found in our own national books that after Pharaoh, the father-in-law of Solomon, no king of Egypt was ever again called by this name, and that afterward the aforementioned woman, ruling over Egypt and Ethiopia, came to Solomon. Of her, we shall speak shortly hereafter. For now I have mentioned these matters in order to show that our books agree with those of the Egyptians on many points. King Solomon subdued those of the Canaanites who still would not submit, who dwelt on Mount Lebanon and as far as the city of Hamath, and imposed tribute on them, and levied from among them each year those who would serve him, perform household labor, and work the land. For none of the Hebrews served as a slave, nor would it have been reasonable, when God had given them many nations subject to their power, to reduce them to this condition and draw upon them for such menial labor. Rather, all of them lived armed, campaigning on chariots and horses, rather than serving as slaves. But over the Canaanites whom he had reduced to servitude, he appointed officers, 550 in number, who received full charge over them from the king, so as to instruct them in the works and tasks to which each whatever these peoples needed from him, he required. The king also built many ships in the Egyptian Gulf of the Red Sea, at a place called Gazan Gabilos, not far from the city of Elanias, now called Berenice, for that region had formerly belonged to the Jews. He received from Hiram, king of Tyre, the gift suited to fitting out the fleet, for Hiram sent him enough skilled pilots and men versed in seafaring, whom he ordered to sail with Solomon's own stewards to the land once called Sapphira and now called the Golden Land, which belongs to India, and bring him back gold. They gathered about 400 talents and returned again to the king. Now the queen who at that time ruled over Egypt and Ethiopia, a woman practiced in wisdom and remarkable in every other way, heard from those who reported to her daily of Solomon's virtue and understanding, and was seized with a longing to see him for herself. For she was to be persuaded by trial, not by hearsay, which is naturally inclined to give credit even to a false report, and then to be talked out of it again, resting as it does entirely on those who bring it. Wishing above all to test his wisdom for herself, and setting out riddles she desired him to solve, she came to Jerusalem with a great show of splendor and wealth, bringing camels laden with gold, spices of every kind, and costly stones. The king received her gladly on her arrival, was in every other respect eager to please her, and easily grasped, faster than anyone expected, the puzzle she put to him with his own understanding. She was astonished to find Solomon's wisdom so far surpassing what she had heard, and greater by trial than by report, but she marveled most of all at the palace, both for its beauty and its size, and no less for the arrangement of its buildings. For in this, too, she recognized the king's great understanding. She was utterly amazed by the house called the Forest of Lebanon, by the extravagance of his daily banquets, by the preparation and service of them, by the dress of those who waited at table, and by the skill and decorum with which they served, and not least by the sacrifices offered daily to God and the diligence of the priests and Levites in performing them. Seeing these things day after day, she was overcome with wonder, and unable to contain her astonishment at what she saw, she made plain how deeply she was affected, for she was moved to say to the king, in words that thoroughly confessed how far her judgment had been overcome by what she had seen. Everything, O king, that comes to knowledge through hearsay is received with mistrust, but as for the good things which you yourself possess, I mean your wisdom and understanding, and those which your kingdom gives you, the report that reached us was not false after all. Being true, it showed a happiness far less than what I now see before me, present here myself. For report attempted only to persuade the ear, but it did not make known the true worth of things as the sight of them, and the actual presence among them establishes it. I, at least, having put no trust in what was told me, on account of the abundance and greatness of what I inquired about, have found by far more than this to record. Blessed indeed, I judge, is the people of the Hebrews, and blessed your servants and friends, who day after day enjoy the sight of you and continue to listen to your wisdom. One might well bless the God who has so loved this land and those who dwell in it as to make you its king. Having made plain through her words how the king had affected her, she also made her disposition clear through her gifts, for she gave him 20 talents of gold, an incalculable quantity of spices, and a costly stone. It is said, too, that we owe the root of the balsam, which our land still bears to this day, to this woman's gift. Solomon repaid her generously with many good things, and above all with whatever she chose to ask for there was nothing she desired to receive that he did not grant, but he gave more readily than she asked, of his own free will, displaying his magnanimity by anticipating what she wished to obtain. And so the queen of the Egyptians and Ethiopians, having received what we have described and having in turn given the king what was hers, returned to her own country. At about this same time, there were also brought to the king, from the land called the Golden Land, costly stone and pine timber, which he used to support the temple and the palace, and for the making of musical instruments, harps and lyres, so that the Levites might sing hymns to God. Of all that was ever brought to him, what arrived on that day surpassed the rest in both size and beauty. Let no one suppose that the pine wood we speak of resembles what is now sold under that name by dealers to impress buyers, for that wood is like fig wood in appearance, but whiter and more lustrous. We have said this, since the king's use of it brought it to our attention, thinking it timely and useful to make the distinction known, so that no one should be ignorant of the difference or of the true nature of pine wood. The weight of the gold brought to him came to 666 talents, not counting what was bought from merchants, or the gifts sent him by the governors and kings of Arabia. He cast the gold into 200 shields, each weighing 600 shekels, and he made 300 targets, each carrying 3 minas of gold, and he had these carried and set up in the house called the Forest of Lebanon. He likewise had cups made of gold and precious stone for banqueting, fashioned with all the artistry he could command, and contrived every other kind of vessel in lavish abundance, all of gold, for there was nothing anyone sold or bought again for silver. He kept many ships, which the king stationed on the sea called Tarshish, and ordered to carry every kind of merchandise into the interior of foreign nations, from the sale of which silver and gold were brought back to the king, along with much ivory, Ethiopians, and apes. The voyage out and back took 3 years to complete. A brilliant fame went round the whole surrounding country, proclaiming the virtue and wisdom of Solomon, so that kings everywhere longed to come into his presence, disbelieving through sheer astonishment what was told of him, and sought to display their zeal for him with great gifts. For they sent him vessels of gold and silver, purple garments, many kinds of spices, horses and chariots, and as many pack mules as they judged, by their strength and beauty, would please the king's eye. So that to the chariots and horses he already had, he added from what was sent to him, bringing the number of chariots to 400 more than before, for he had had 1,000, and the number of horses to 2,000 more, for he possessed 20,000 horses. These were trained for beauty and speed, so that none could be found more handsome or swifter than they, but they were seen to be the finest of all, and their swiftness beyond rivaling. Those who rode them added to their splendor, for they were in the first bloom of youth, most delightful to look upon, and remarkable for their height, standing well above other men, letting their hair grow to the greatest length, and dressed in tunics of Tyrian purple. Gold dust was sprinkled daily on their hair, so that their heads shone with the gleam of gold reflected against the sun. With these men about him, armed and carrying bows at the ready, the king himself, riding in a chariot and dressed in white, was accustomed to set out for his excursions. There was a certain place about 2 hours' journey from Jerusalem, called Etam, delightful and rich alike for its gardens and the flow of its springs, and it was there that he rode out for his outings. Employing in everything a more than human ingenuity and diligence, and being exceedingly devoted to beauty, he did not neglect even the roads, but paved with black stone those leading to Jerusalem, which was the royal city, both to ease the going of travelers on foot and to make plain the dignity of his wealth and rule. Having divided the chariots and arranged them so that a fixed number should be stationed in each city, he kept few about himself, and he called these cities chariot cities. The king made so great an abundance of silver in Jerusalem as of stone, and of cedar wood, previously unknown there, as of the sycamore trees which abound on the plains of Judea. He also ordered the merchants of Egypt who brought him chariots and horses to sell each chariot with 2 horses for 600 silver drachmas, and he in turn sent these on to the kings of Syria and those beyond the Euphrates.